few statistics to start out. You know, 30 years ago, when I was involved with Organic Ag, there really were no real statistics around to be had. It was barely a blip on anybody's radar screen. And we've come a long way since then. In 2008, the organic sales were almost $25 billion, which makes organic roughly 3.5% of the total food system these days. Now, what's interesting is that was a growth of over 17% from the previous year. And that is not a fluke, as it turns out. If you look, since 1994, organic sales have risen by almost 20% annually. And, you know, if you project that off into the future, within less than a decade, organic could be as much as 10% of America's food system. And the likelihood that that'll continue looks pretty good. ERS just released a report, and they reported that price premiums for organic products are still high, that the sales are widening in all categories, and something that we've been observing for quite a few years now, and that's that organic is mainstreaming. There are people buying organic foods that we never expected would be buying organic products at all. And organic products are available now in mainstream venues. Almost half of organic food is sold in big box stores like Walmart and Hy-Vee, IGA, something that's totally unexpected. This sort of gives you a perspective on where organic acreage and farms are at. There is certified organic production now in all 50 states. And in 2005, ERS determined that we were at about 4 million acres. That puts us number four in the world. Number one is Australia, and they've got, get this, 10 times as much organic acreage as we have. And two and three are Argentina and China, respectively. So how did we get there? That's mainly what I'm here to present. There are two myths, sort of popular myths, on how organic agriculture came into being. One is that it was kind of a counterculture phenomena. You know, a bunch of hippies in the 60s get together, started organic agriculture. The other myth is that organic is just simply farming as it was before there was chemicals. That simple. Both of those assumptions are basically wrong, but like with most myths, there's always a little germ of truth there, and you'll see that as we go along. Actually, organic began as an idea or an ideal in the early part of the 20th century, around the 19-teens, 1920s. And it solidified then as you move into the 1940s as a real system of farming. And what the pioneers of organic were reacting to or trying to address were really perennial problems of agriculture. They were concerned about nutrient depletion, erosion, low-quality food, livestock and plant diseases, rural poverty, the effect of food quality on the human population. And what they observed looking back historically was that history is replete with societies that have failed because they've mismanaged their resources through their agriculture, a non-sustainable agriculture. And they also observed that there were societies that had sustained agricultural production for millennia. So there were models out there for them to look at and draw on for their ideas for a new agriculture. Now, at this point in time, we've got a sort of a proto-chemical agriculture coming into being too. Von Liebig's work was done in the late 1800s, and there was a lot of interest in soluble fertilization at that time. And the way the pioneers of organic kind of looked at that was that it would not really solve the breadth of problems that they were seeing with agriculture. And in some cases, they felt it would worsen it. So really, sort of from the beginning, there were sort of two trends, a growing apart of the conventional chemical approach and this organic approach. And what evolved on the organic side was something called humus farming, which, like I said, it drew on ideas from sustainable systems in the Far East, but also in the West. Convertible husbandry was a movement in around the 1830s in the US that focused a lot on manure management and crop rotation. And hay farming from Europe, which was a diverse rotation scheme for farming. It was called humus farming until around the 1940s. Then an article was written in a popular magazine where the author had visited a humus farm, and he observed that it was like an organism in terms of how the nutrient flows and the energy flows occurred, and he called it organic, and that just caught on from then. About 100 years ago, when I was in school taking my first soils and fertilizers class, University of Wisconsin, I was taught in the opening day that there were two legitimate strategies for fertilizing crops. One was to fertilize the soil and let the soil system fertilize crops, and the other was to make fertilizers soluble and provide them directly to the crop. Well, from that point on, we kept talking about soluble fertilizers and never looked back. So this humus farming approach, which is based on the idea of feeding the soil, was really like the path not taken. Feeding the soil, of course, is about feeding the soil food web. I don't need to go into detail with this group here, Steve. I think you're going to be covering a lot of that. But that idea of feeding the soil led to something called the law of return, which to organic growers meant returning organic matter. Not just the nutrients that would be contained in organic matter, but organic materials as crop residues, manures, or whatever. The humus farming approach was based on what they call natural system. In fact, it was sometimes called nature farming. And the whole idea was relying on the soil food web, which in nature pretty much functions as the stomach of the plant. You know, it digests all the organic waste, the plant residues, animal remains, and so on, cycles nutrients back and forth, and maintains a certain amount in soluble form for plant roots to pick up. But we know that that's not all that the soil food web does. It provides glomalin, which gives soil its structure, acids that etch more of the nutrients out of the parent rock material, antibiotics that help control disease organisms in the soil, and a whole host of chemicals that the plants can absorb that researchers in the 30s started calling phytamins, things like chelated nutrients, actual vitamins, growth factors, things we don't entirely understand yet. Under conventional management, as they viewed it, the idea being to provide all the nutrition in soluble form directly to the plant roots. With that type of system, it just sort of naturally evolved that the soil food web would be ignored. If you ignore it, not feed it, just like not feeding your dog, it becomes skinny and diminished. Add in the fact that some pesticides and fertilizers also impact the soil web, narrow the diversity. And you've got a weakened system that can provide very little to the plants. And this is, in essence, really why, when conventional systems transition to organic, that yields are low and there's a load of pest problems. It takes a while for that soil food web, which an organic system is dependent on, to rebuild and function. So under the organic strategy, it's really, the notion is enhancing and optimizing the soil food web so that you get a maximum amount of not only soluble minerals, but all these other benefits too. And if you'll note there on the left, the strategy provides very little soluble mineral directly to the plant roots. The basic strategy is to work through the soil food web. And because of that, we hear that, or you've probably heard, that organic is a soil-based production system. It's also encouraged certain kind of thinking in crop management as a whole. In the conventional paradigm, we tend to think of things in a compartmentalized way. You do ABC for crop nutrition and XYZ for pest management. A little bit different thinking. It's more systematic, more interrelated in organic thinking, whereby they're thinking that every action they take, whether it's rotation, tillage, applying an allowed pesticide, that it has impacts in all areas, sometimes good and sometimes bad. Something I was trying to impart to you is that the organic thinkers were pioneers were very holistic in their thinking. They were looking at the impact and the interrelationships of agriculture and society as a whole. And they had this notion that, you know, what you ate might actually make a difference as to how you feel. And of course, healthy people are more productive, creating a healthier society as a whole, that it impacts all the way up. And the base is the soil. And their contention, of course, being that this humus farming system would create healthier food. And that leads us to one hypothesis that's kind of at the core of organics, and that's that the food that's produced is somehow better for you, that somehow it's healthier. And this is a strong driver, of course, on the organic market today. And today it centers really around three issues. The traditional one is that there's more nutrition in organic food. That, you know, the organic apple I have over here has something or more of something that's good for me than the conventional apple. The second issue, and this one came sort of into being in the 60s and 70s, relates to what that organic apple does not have, which is pesticide residues. And the issue there is not so much whether organic has more or less than conventional. That's pretty much established by research. The question usually rests on how much difference does it make to human health if you're consuming those residues. And the third issue, which came about here in the 90s, is the issue of genetic engineering. The Frankenfood issue has been a big one. And, you know, in case you're not aware, organic agriculture, according to our national standard, does preclude the use of genetically engineered crops and other inputs. The only one I'm going to comment on in any detail here is the original assertion that organic food is more nutritious. And you will see periodically research coming out on both sides of this issue. Recently, I think about 3-4 months ago, there was a review done in the UK that claimed, you know, there was no essential difference. I understand, I saw a blurb last week, this is a French study, of course, that found out the alternative, that it's more nutritious. These things are going to be coming out for a long time into the future. But the UK study, which a lot of people focused on, was criticized on one particular issue, and that was that it left out a lot of the studies related to total antioxidant content. And, I mean, I've not studied this in depth, but it seems to me, from the literature that I've seen, that that is the area that we're seeing an advantage in organic foods, is in total antioxidants, things like polyphenols, flavonoids, and such. If anybody wants to plug into this issue, the Organic Center is a great place to go and get that sort of information. The Organic Center, of course, is biased, but they're at the center of all the controversy. If you want to plug into where the literature is at, that's the place to start. And I've got a few handouts up here if anybody wants these websites and things. Feel free to grab that when this is over. There's another hypothesis that I thought I would mention here that's a traditional hypothesis, and that's that organic crops show a natural resistance to many, and some organic producers, some traditional ones, would say all pests. And I'm not talking here about the standard genetic resistance that we talk about, though there's a genetic component on some level. And I'm also not talking about natural biocontrol. The assertion is that that crops are not inherently susceptible to pests, but that as a result of environmental stresses, particularly the growing systems that we use, that there is something lacking in those systems that makes the plants vulnerable. I mean, just in the way that when we're under stress, we tend to be more vulnerable to colds and flu. It's that same concept. And this was originally written about, but the place I first read about it was in Albert Howard's 1947 book, The Soil and Health. Albert Howard's kind of considered the father of organic agriculture. And he described plots he was growing with compost and rotation that were pest-free, you know, right adjacent to fields that were loaded with crop pests. Now, I always assumed that that was strictly an organic assertion. Just recently, I started to plug into this body of literature that actually exists on that. They refer to this as predisposition theory. And the work on this goes back to like the late 1800s. And it started with fungal diseases in plants and work with that, but expanded to basically all kinds of species. In fact, you might hear organic producers say that insect pests are like the garbage men of nature, in that the pests exist mainly to take out the unproductive plants, those that are genetically inferior or otherwise performing poorly. And this kind of thinking has encouraged kind of a plant-positive approach to growing crops. It's the idea that, okay, I've got a pest problem. You may control it with, you know, an allowed pesticide, but you're always thinking, you know, what's wrong with my system? What do I need to change that will get rid of this pest infestation in the future? Some of the mechanisms, and like I said, I only got to scan some of this research, but there's sort of three mechanisms that floated to the surface. One is the notion that excess free nitrogen in crops draws pests, and I know there's work with aphids that you know, shows a positive correlation on that. Phytochemicals in the plant, you know, a lot of plants produce chemicals that cause resistance to pests, and you know, if in fact organic crops do produce more antioxidants, these would just be other phytochemicals that they might be producing. And a real interesting and popular theory that's around right now relates to dissolved plant solids. It's part of a movement you might have heard of for nutrient-dense foods. Pest resistance is supposedly a side benefit of this higher quality food. The logic, as I've heard some people play it out, is that insect pests have problems processing plant sap that has higher dissolved solids. Whatever the mechanism, and I suspect that all those mechanisms may have some role with some pests or whatever, you know, what is it about an organic system that could possibly bring this about? And again, going back to Albert Howard, he focused in on the soil food web and the benefits of that web. And he wrote specifically and really zeroed in on mycorrhizal associations and, you know, the fact that in a biologically active soil, you have more of those associations and that they're benefiting the crops through absorption of water, absorption of phosphate, and absorption of those large organic molecules, the things they called phytamins or lumped under the title of phytamins, which again throws back, now we'll go way back in theory. Now, before von Liebig, there was this humus theory of plant nutrition, which said that plants got all their nutrition by absorbing organic molecules. Well, von Liebig, you know, pretty much threw that out the window, and we focused on soluble minerals. And that's accepted in the organic community. There's really no question of that. But there's also that recognition that there is absorption of the large organic molecules. And it seems most of the controversy is over how much difference that actually makes to the quality of food, to plant, natural plant resistance, to everything else. There's just some of the literature that I plugged into for that. I want to get back on the timeline. We'll go back to the 1960s again. Even though this was not when organic farming was invented, this was a very important period. There was a counterculture movement under the way that was reacting against the industrialization of food. That sort of generated a back to the land movement. And there was also this environmental and ecology movement that was coming into being. And really, they kind of looked around, found organic agriculture, and co-opted it. Gave it a whole new set of sort of political tones to it. Originally, back in the 40s and the 50s, I'll call it the political tone for lack of another term. For the organic community, it was very conservative, reactionary, populist politically. And of course, after the 60s, we tend to associate it with radical liberal politics on the other end of the scale. But, you know, more importantly than that political tone, it gave organic agriculture a marketplace. Really created the interest in it. It helped marry it to the environmental movement, which was a great thing. On the negative side, a lot of the bad public relations that organic got came out of this era. And part of that was a result of so many people rushing back to the land, focusing on that aspect of organics, which is the negative side. Not using pesticides, not using fertilizers, but forgetting that or that there is a system that you have to put in place for this to work well, that whole humus farming system. And as a result, there was a lot of sorry produce being produced. And, you know, as a young person in college at the time, I went in the food co-ops. You know, I saw a lot of that stuff, and I turned up my nose at it, too. But that's, of course, what a lot of the critics focused on. And, you know, that legacy sort of carries over yet until today. You know, sad because there were a lot of good organic farmers around then that they could have been looking at too. The 60s and 70s were a major influence, and they really give us a lot of our ideas of what organic means. And probably the best description of this came from Michael Pollan in his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. And he described organic as having really like three legs on a stool. One is the alternative production system, which we've been talking about, humus farming system. And another was the alternative delivery systems. And you did not buy organic food in the early years in a supermarket. That was for industrial food. If you weren't buying it directly from the farmer, you were getting it through buying clubs, co-ops, health food stores, almost like an underground economy. and organic, probably most importantly, people thought of as a counter cuisine. It was about fresh food. It was about whole food, about no contaminants, preservatives in your food. And in fact, there's an old debate about whether or not you can have an organic version of a Twinkie. And you know, under this vision, it's not likely that you could. So anyway, the organic community, the organic market keeps growing through the 70s, up into the 80s. And toward the end of the 80s, you've got, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 certification organizations, and close to that many versions of what a standard for production ought to be. But you needed a trigger event for change. And what happened in 1989 is still called today the ALAR scare. And ALAR was a growth regulator chemical that was used in the ripening of apples. And the EPA had been looking at it as a suspected carcinogen. And the news magazine, 60 Minutes, got a hold of that story and did a piece on it. And all of a sudden, people all over the country were looking for organic food, mothers particularly, for their babies. And I mean, this was great for the organic community for probably about 5 minutes or so, because then people started slapping the organic label on anything they could get their hands on. You know, it was an unregulated environment and they could get away with it. So some representatives from the organic community, there was a trade association in existence then, went to Senator Patrick Leahy and some others in Congress and really asked for regulation. And rather quickly, I mean, within a year, we got the Organic Foods Production Act. It was in 1990. And this is what created the National Organic Program. It mandated the creation of a National Organic Standards Board and set the stage for the federal regulation that we've got today. OFPA, the Organic Food Production Act, was passed very quickly after things were set in motion. But getting regulation to follow on that legislation took a while. It was 7 years before we got a draft of regulation. And there were a number of problems with it. The biggest problems that the organic community focused in on were called the Big Three, and those were the use of it allowed for the use of sewage sludge in organic production. It allowed for irradiation of organic food, and it allowed for genetic engineering. And the USDA, in response to this draft of the regulation, got 275,000 public comments. Now, to give a perspective on that, I've heard some DC lawyers say that if an issue has got a lot of public attention, you will get 2,000 to 3,000 comments. This was 275,000. So the USDA learned a big lesson here on how much interest there was and how active a community, the organic community, was. To add a little bit more perspective to that, the Organic Farming Research Foundation, which was really the only entity at that time that was giving us any statistics on farms, they were telling us that we're only about 4,000 to 5,000 organic farms, certified organic farms, at that point in time. So the 275,000 comments were coming from mostly consumers, the people that were going to buy organic food. And they were telling the USDA very particularly that they didn't want genetic engineering. So if you need to trace that back to a particular event, it's right here. Anyhow, finally, after some work and some tweaking, we got a national standard. And that national standard really just deals with the production system and the handling and processing end of things. a lot of the issues people were concerned about in the 60s and 70s, things like scale of production, local foods issues, social justice and that, these were really left out of the national standard. In fact, if you look at Michael Pollan's model, basically alternative delivery systems, you know, as I told you earlier, about half of organic food right now is coming out of those same supermarkets that you couldn't have found organic in 25, 30 years ago. And as for counter cuisine, part of the national list that is a part of the National Organic Standard is synthetic products or materials that can be allowed in organic products. The USDA label can be used on products that have 5% non-organic content, and that can include things that probably wouldn't bother you very much, but they are synthetics and they are now allowed in organic production, or in organic processing rather. And remember that organic Twinkie? Well, you could probably make an organic version of the Twinkie these days. I don't know that anybody's certifying one of those, but if they did, it would not be mom and pop down the street. Organic is big business, and the big players are now in it. And it wasn't that long ago that I used to get calls saying, well, if organic, you know, isn't just a fluke, why aren't the big guys in it? And all you have to do is show them a chart like this. They're in there. These charts are created by Phil Howard at Michigan State University, and he updates them several times a year. Every time one is published, it's out of date because there's always new acquisitions and new lines of products. So it's an ongoing growing proposition. Make one more discussion slide here. Also, our notion of what can be certified as an organic system has evolved too. And this is partly, I think, a result of how much focus we put on what is allowed and not allowed in organic production. Humus farming, the type of system that I described here, is still at the core. It's the basic organic production system. But you can now certify organic hydroponic systems. I mean, so much for soil-based systems. Organic by neglect is largely being excluded, but the certifiers that I work with, you know, say that is an issue. They have people right on the margins with that. Input substitution, just to explain that, that is the notion that really comes from a conventional mindset that we can convert to organic simply by taking the conventional product, throwing that out the door, and substituting an organically allowed product. It loses recognition of the fact that this is a different way of farming, a different philosophy and approach. That pretty much concludes my remarks. Like I said, I've got some handouts here if anybody would like to pick them up. It's got the references in that that I've referred to here. And on that, Joe, I'm finished.
Organic farming more economically viable for the farmers. There are only 5,000.
Okay. I would say that's an area, there's a big area of challenge there for the biotech community. And really, to date, in my opinion, have handled it extremely poorly. All the efforts at suppressing labeling has seemed to rely and is read by the organic community as what are they trying to conceal and what are they trying to force down our throats. And that's the perception. I think it's as much a reaction against the unknown and the uncertainty than anything else. But yeah, it's been handled badly. If there is ever going to be that change, it is going to be a long time in coming. And the biotech community has a lot of work to do on that score. Jim. Tell them who you are, Jim.
Jim Riddle, University of Minnesota, Organic Outreach Coordinator, former chair of the National Organic Standards Board, longtime organic inspector. Well, organic, as you said, is based on working in harmony with the earth, harmony with natural systems, and the BT crops is just the opposite. It's based on control and reductionism at the very core, at the genetic level. And, so with the BT, the toxic property has been removed and inserted into the crop, and it's toxic in every cell of the plant at all times, which is very different than the naturally occurring BT toxin that's found in the soil. And we're seeing now the toxicity of this pesticide that's in the plant, killing a caddisfly larva and altering aquatic ecosystems. We're seeing a massive decline in Lepidopteran, specifically monarch and swallowtail populations. So we're seeing that this hasn't actually resulted in a reduction in pesticide because every cell of the plant is pesticidal and is having ecological impacts. So there's actually much more pesticide being applied through the use of BT crops than there was through the standard insecticides that were being used and were replaced by this technology. Organic is based on harmony with nature, but also a precautionary approach, as you're talking about, really knowing that the inputs that are used are compatible with natural systems, and we're seeing just the opposite with this BT technology.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to talk about, you talk about organic and conventional. I work for USDA, I work with organic, and I write the policy. And I was on the definition for organic back in the 90s. When you start talking about the production system, crop rotation, you do it in both. IPM, you do it in both. If you want to take crop conservation tillage, these are the things that you work with to cycle the nutrients. It's not so much so different. It's looking at a system that is ecological equilibrium with the surroundings. And I think that's one of the things, the marketing side, of course, you don't want to use pesticides. In an IPM system, you look at it and say, when should I put it on? Or should I use a pesticide? I'm not so sure that they are boxes. It's how it's been misused of chemical, and you can take organic if you use manure, you wind up with too much phosphorus. So you need to balance that with a long rotation. See, it's not, I'm a little confused about each one is so different. It's how, what's the commonality and how can we keep the ecological niche? Because if you cultivate too much, you got erosion. And I think we need to look at not only the consumer, but look at the environment, make sure it has a equilibrium that is sustainable.
Oh, I really don't disagree with that. But, let's, look back at the examples. Yes, rotation, for example, can be done in conventional and in organic. It's required in organic systems. I mean, I've been through a lot of the Midwest. I don't see much evidence of a soil-building crop rotation out there in conventional production. That would have to be a choice, and once that choice is made, I mean, they tend to fall. And yeah, I mean, I don't like the semantics of all these little boxes either. But when someone puts a soil-building rotation in place, whether they're conventional or whether they're organic, they have created a more sustainable production system and one that is more in balance, as you're saying. Absolutely, and that can be done under conventional management.
We'd like to thank George very much for his talk.